senatorial country gent, a former army officer, in what he sees as a pragmatic marriage, no children, he has a younger mistress in London, is married to somebody who brings out a book of poems. And his first reaction is, and I'm quoting, he noticed that the volume contained no more than 90 pages. That was all to the good. He shared Edgar Allan Poe's opinion that poems should be short. But as he turned the pages, he noticed that several of Evie's had long lines of irregular length and didn't rhyme. He didn't like that. So there's this very conventional view of what poetry should be up against somebody who's trying to do something innovative. The Colonel, you remember, doesn't read with any care, but he tells his wife he thinks the book's jolly good. And he's surprised when people start to congratulate her through him, and even more surprised when the book turns out to be a big critical and commercial success. There are publishers' events in London and invitations to even grander houses than they're used to, all of this through his wife. And at one of these parties, he realizes that people are talking about him, and so he thinks he'd probably better read the book more carefully, and realizes, of course, that it's partly autobiographical and that it's about the fact that his wife had an affair with a younger man. He goes straight to his solicitor and discusses this situation with him, and the solicitor's kind of intelligent, liberal, rather probing, and asks him various mild questions, like, have you always been faithful to her? He says, more or less, you know, after all, we've been married for nearly 24 years, and I won't deny that I've had a bit of fun now and then. A man wants it, women are different. And the solicitor says, we have only men's word for that. Now, you all know how the story ends. I just want to make a few initial points. The first is that, like all of Morm's work, it's very simply and plainly written and traditionally constructed. Secondly, that despite that traditionalism, it's apparently paradoxically interested in and sympathetic to experimentalism in art. The story is clearly sympathetic to Evie's own experiments. Thirdly, that the story, and again this applies throughout Morm's work, is conscious of female sexuality and critical both of the double standard practiced in relation to it by men, and relatedly critical of married men's sense, conventional middle class English married men's sense that they sort of own their wives. Fourthly, that the story, and again this is very common in his work, is absorbed in ordinary problems that ordinary people face, and particularly in long relationships. I don't mean necessarily ordinary in class terms, but these problems are not confined to one class or another. And finally, that there is an issue to do with how narrative, whether prose or poetry or drama, can be an outlet for a writer psychologically, that however it works in terms of its readership, that it is a way for the writer, or can be a way for the writer, of making intolerable situations less intolerable. Now, I'll come back to these points in various ways, but the first thing I want to say now is that 3 years ago, I had not read a word of Morm, not a word. His is one of those names that a generation hears mentioned admiringly by an older generation and tends partly for that reason to dismiss. Like Nick with his epiphany about the wasteland and early radio, my conversion, if you like, came about through a student. In this case, someone who was doing an MA dissertation. She was South African and she'd read a great deal of Morm. And one of the things about his reputation is that it's continued to be stronger in former British colonies and in countries overseas than in the UK itself. I'm going to be talking quite a bit about reputation and how and its vagaries. So because of her interest, I had to read some more because she was writing about him, and I began to get very interested. I'd already been quite conscious of something that George Orwell wrote in his 1940 essay, Inside the Whale. Orwell is on our syllabus, and you'll be coming to him next term as an essayist. And on the top of the handout you've got is this quotation: the first test of any work of art is survival. The first test of any work of art is survival, and it is a fact, this was in 1940, that a great deal that was written in the period 1910 to 30 has survived and looks like continuing to survive. One has only to think of Ulysses by James Joyce, of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham, most of Lawrence's early work, especially his short stories, and virtually the whole of Eliot's poems up to 1930, to wonder what is being written now in 1940 that will survive so well. Now, one answer to Orwell's question is, in fact, Orwell's own work. But what I want to think about here for a moment are a couple of things. First, the linkage Orwell makes, surprisingly it can now seem, between Maugham and some of the other writers on his list. And second, the claim that survival is a critical criterion in itself. In fact, he says the first test of any work of art. And the questions that that raises. Between 1913 and 1915, three novels were published in London, which would eventually be translated all over the world and studied all over the world. Each of them involves a clever, turbulent boy growing up. They're all male central characters. He's struggling with his family background and with his sexuality, attracted by the idea of being an artist and setting out into adult life. So they're all Bildungsromanen, novels of development and growth. That's B-I-L-D-U-N-G-S, Bildungsroman, R-O-M-A-N. Each of them is a Bildungsroman. Two of them belong to the subgenre of the Bildungsroman, the Künstlerroman, which is the novel of the development of an artist. And they are Sons and Lovers by D.H. Lawrence, Portrait of the Artist, which is on the syllabus and which you'll be talking about in week 7 when you come back from reading week, and Maugham's of Human Bondage, which is the longest of the three works. Now, of those three writers, Maugham was the eldest. He was born in 1874, and he was also the most established when these three books came out. He had made quite a name for himself in the 19th century, in 1897, with a book called Liza of Lambeth, a social realist novel about working class life in East London, which had grown out of his experiences as a medical student, practicing and training in that part of London. He'd also become very well known as a playwright. In 1907, he had four different plays running simultaneously in the West End of London. That's today a very hard record to match, but it was the first time anybody had achieved that in his day. As far as the life of a modern artist is concerned, and each of these books involves an ambition to be an artist, Maugham knew about this at first hand. He had lived in Paris, and he'd been friendly there with a young painter and sculptors and critics. And the tormented central character of Human Bondage, which is not a set text, I know you haven't read it, this tormented central character, Philip Carey, in fact rejects a career as an artist in favor of one as a doctor. In so doing, he reflects his author's experience, but of course reverses it. Maugham trained as a doctor and then decided to be a writer. He also makes a completely different decision from the ones that are followed by Stephen Dedalus in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Lawrence's central character, Paul Morel. Now, biographically, there are other important differences between these writers, and I think biography can be important in our understanding of writers, and particularly so in the case of Maugham, but you need to be aware that this approach is disapproved of quite a lot in academic literary circles. So don't do too much of it yourself. Morm, first of all, one of the differences is that Morm took part in the First World War, unlike the others. He was a medical orderly in the First World War, and he behaved with skill and courage and as that. And later he went into the intelligence service. And if you read Ashendon, from which His Excellency is taken, story that you've been given to read, Ashendon is a collection of short stories presented rather bogusly as a novel. It's very innovative because it's one of the first collection, because of the spy element, and Ashendon is a spy and a precursor of James Bond in various ways. But Ashendon has a very modest introduction in which Morm says truthfully, in 1917 I went to Russia. I was sent to prevent the Bolshevik Revolution and to keep Russia in the war, the First World War. The reader will know that my efforts did not meet with success. So he was an active and quite important, in terms of the intelligence work, participant in the First World War. And he was also the only one of the three writers, Joyce, Lawrence and Morm, to live to be an old man. But while Joyce and Lawrence saw their reputations grow exponentially, Morm lived to see his fall into decline. And I'll come on to that. In his day, he was immensely celebrated, in his youth particularly. Rain, one of the stories that you've got, that I've asked you to read, made millions of dollars out of stage and screen adaptations over a long period of time. There were many such. He was probably the richest writer in terms of income from writing in his lifetime. But as I've said, his reputation as a writer shrank, particularly in his old age. Now, this doesn't make him absolutely unique, and I want to point out that Lawrence's reputation, though far from extinct, has been in decline in recent years. How many people in this room have read anything by D.H. Lawrence? About a third of you. Now, if this were 40 years ago, if this were 1970, everybody in this room would have read Women in Love or Sons and Lovers or Lady Chatterley's Lover or some of the short stories or some of the poems. So reputations can, you know, like they tell you about investments, can go down as well as up. Second point is that although Morm's critical reputation is not high, most of his work is in print. It's not at all difficult to get anything by Morm. Most of his novels, most of his short stories, and if you search Amazon under his full name, you get 2,000 results in the UK and 5,000-6,000 in the USA, in American Amazon. So survival is not just a matter of what is on every university syllabus and what isn't, nor is it a matter of who is written about by people who are regarded as serious critics. Some of you I know have already found that there is nothing or next to nothing in the library about W. Somerset Maugham. I'm glad about that because it means that you are on your own mettle as readers to make your own decisions, and if you decide to write about Maugham, you'll be doing it unaided, and I hope those of you who do decide that will find that an interesting challenge, whether what you have to say is positive or negative, and I don't make any presuppositions about that. Now, Morm is not only not admired, and I'll come on to the reasons I think that lie behind that, but he's actively disliked by some of the people who have read him. Perhaps he's disliked by some of you. And the case that's often made against him has three main elements. First, people say that his style is dull and traditional and was already dated when he started writing. It doesn't have the experimentalism and the novelty of Lawrence's style or Joyce's style in its day. Secondly, some people say that his books are misogynistic. Thirdly, some people say that they're snobbish or classist. Now, I'll deal with these points in a moment, but I want, first of all, to talk about the short story as a form in a very introductory and inevitably cursory way. Now, all artistic forms are almost infinitely adaptable. There are no clear rules that define them. They are there as a kind of taxonomy, a way of making, among other things, of making comparisons, of giving the writer some guidelines and of giving us as readers something to compare with something else. So if you're looking for a flat to rent, you'll look at a list of other flats to rent rather than of houses or of houseboats. But on the other hand, you may find at the margins that a certain flat becomes comparable with a certain house, or a certain flat becomes comparable with the houseboat, especially if it's down by the river and it's been raining a lot lately. In the same way that there are stories that seem to, short stories that seem to come close to being novels, and there is indeed an in-between genre that we call the novella, meaning a little novel. Equally, there are some stories that are so terse and compact that they seem almost to be prose poems or to aspire to something like that. And you'll read in Kafka's Metamorphosis and other stories, you'll find some stories that might be described in that way. There's a vogue at the moment among East European writers for exceedingly short texts of mixed kind in another sense, that they are partly factual and partly fictional. There's a name for them at the moment, which is minima, that's being used. And I also heard a very good short story writer, Adam Mars Jones, the other night at a prize giving for the V.S. Pritchett Short Story Prize, saying that he really likes stories, short stories that seem to have too much in them to be short stories. And on the other hand, he likes novels that don't seem to be quite fat enough and full enough for novels. So it's a kind of porous category, like all categories in the arts. But one way of defining a short story, if you want a definition, would be that it's a narrative in prose, complete in itself, that can be read at a single sitting. Duration is important in the arts, and particularly in literature, I think. If something takes you weeks and weeks to read, that has a different impact on you from something that you can read in an evening. I don't want to get into that too much, but I do want to get into some helpful kind of attempts at definition, which are on the first page of the handout. There's one by the Russian short story writer, and have you all got a handout? If not, there are some down at the front here and some at the back there. Chekhov, as summarized by another short story writer, V.S. Pritchett, if you don't have handouts, there's a pile down here. And there may be some floating around still. Has anybody got a pile of handouts in their hand? There's some up there. This is how Pritchett summarized what Chekhov said, that characterized the short story. One, absence of lengthy verbiage of political, social, economic nature. Two, total objectivity. Three, truthful descriptions of persons and objects. Four, extreme brevity. Five, audacity and originality. Avoid the stereotype. Six, compassion. Well, the list fits Chekhov's short stories very well. It also fits Pritchett's short stories very well. But, of course, it isn't specific in most of the descriptors to the short story. There are many long novels which have no verbiage of political, social, economic nature. And the criteria numbered 2, 3, 5, and 6 could all be applied to other forms, other genres, other arts, indeed. It could also be argued that the list excludes certain kinds of writing even within the genre of the short story. Fantasy, for example, whimsy, irony. Kafka's short stories are not described by Chekhov's list. Still, there's a kind of starting point here. And another is offered by Pritchett himself, who said that there are two overlapping kinds of short story. There are ones, he said, which are like a closed system, like a sonnet, in which one of the most important elements is a click at the end, the feeling that it's come full circle and it's finished itself off. But there's another that Pritchett described, which is on the handout, where he says, do you at the end of a story feel that the lives of the people have ended with the drama of their situation? Or do you feel that their lives were in fact not lives, but an idea? In fact, I think those are the same thing. Do you, at the end of the story, feel that the lives of the people have ended with the drama of their situation? Do you feel that their lives were, in fact, not lives, but an idea? He, on the other hand, favoured the kind of story at the end of which he said the characters go on living. They're beginning to feel their way into a new situation. Once again, it's a matter of preference rather than of firm rules, but you may want to think about Morm stories in connection with those two different ideas. Now, Morm's idea of a short story was somewhere between several of these. As I've said, he found much to value in contemporary art, particularly visual art. He made a collection of modernist visual art. He actually, among other things, had a notable collection which included a Gauguin painting on glass, which he picked up in Tahiti for kind of a couple of hundred francs. It was in somebody's house, and he said, "You want to sell that?" He knew, though, that the values ascribed to modernism were not doctrinally absolute. They represented one set of views among others, and audiences could enjoy works of very different kinds. I'll come back to that point. As far as literature and theatre were concerned, he admired Chekhov, but not all of Chekhov's imitators. And he insisted that it's quite unnecessary, this is a quotation, it's on the handout in fact, it's quite unnecessary to treat as axiomatic the assertion that fiction should imitate life. There is in fact a second theory that is just as plausible, and this is that fiction should use life merely as raw material which it arranges in ingenious patterns. You might want to think about that, and also think about in your seminar, and might also want to think about whether Morm's stories fit one or other of those categories, or in some cases one and in some cases the other. Certainly the ingenuity that he talks about is often represented in his own short fiction by a twist at the end, a surprise ending. At the end of Rain, for example, which was written around 1917, it becomes clear that the puritanical missionary Davidson has succumbed to what he was trying to suppress in others. In The Lion's Skin, which we don't know the dates when a lot of Morm stories were written, he burnt loads and loads of stuff of his own personal archives in an attempt to cover up various things. I'll also come on to that in a minute. But I think it was probably written in the 1930s. In The Lion's Skin, Forestier's fantasy that he belongs to a social rank higher, or his pretense that he belongs to a social rank higher than is the case, has been demolished. But by the end, unexpectedly, and in a sort of completely pointless act of self-sacrificial courage, he actually earns the description gentleman which Fred Hardy bestows on him. I'll come back to the question of class among all the different things I'm promising to come back to, which I hope I'll have time to. Twists, though, in the sense of unexpected or ironic actions and revelations, are not confined to Morm's endings. And in any case, his stories are as often and as much about the lack of a twist, the sheer inevitability and attrition that govern people's lives very often, as the opposite. The Pool is an example. The stories are varied then, but they are consistent in this respect. They're all interested in the external world, in how environment and social norms bear down on individuals, seen very often from the outside, and in the consequences of actions. In a word, they're interested in plot, and they have plots. Morm, in fact, loves a story and is very interested in storytellers. Many of his characters are storytellers or tell a story within a story. An example, of course, is His Excellency. And when we get on to Heart of Darkness later on, that's, of course, a classic example of this that subgenre, the story within the story, story with a frame, if you like. Now, Morm's interest in storytelling is one of the reasons why his work fell out of fashion, or at least out of intellectual literary fashion. And to explain this, I need to talk briefly about the propaganda put out by the literary modernists of prose, particularly as far as the English novel is concerned, by members of the Bloomsbury Group. In doing so, for present purposes, I'll broadly take Morm's side, but you'll hear plenty about the other side in the coming weeks. Virginia Woolf and James Joyce, as I said, we come on to both of those after reading week, were exact contemporaries. They had very different backgrounds and educations, but they were both of them influenced by current developments in psychology, particularly Freud's writings on the unconscious, which were first published between 1900 and 1915. And also, and I've given you on the second page of the handout at the bottom some dates of publications of works that I allude to. And they were also, Virginia Woolf and James Joyce, very interested in the arts, as was Morm, although Woolf and Joyce allowed what was happening in the visual arts to affect the way they wrote more than Morm did. They were particularly interested in Impressionism and Post-Impressionism, an exhibition mounted by a member of the Bloomsbury group, Roger Fry, at the Grafton Galleries in 1910, Manet and the Post-Impressionists. And in both these cases, psychology and the visual arts, the new concern, broadly speaking, was to dig under surfaces, to dig below surface appearances and or conventional versions of those appearances, and to identify and record the responses of the subjective self. In literary terms, what this came to was, again, very simply, a kind of version of a brain scan, an attempt to depict the workings of the actual mind, rather than an interest in more external accounts of character and action. And anything that seemed to prioritize plot and action, anything particularly that seemed to depend on suspense, anything that might be called a page-turner, was seen as obsolete and somehow, as we'll see in a moment, socially inferior as well. Woolf developed her ideas along these lines in a number of essays which were published between 1919 and 1925. Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown, in particular, 1919, was a widely read attack on the novelist Arnold Bennett, with whom Somerset Maugham had quite a lot in common, particularly interest in storytelling and in social context. But even more influential on the next generation of critics was E.M. Forster's book Aspects of the Novel, which began as a series of lectures given in a prestigious series at Cambridge, the Clark Lectures, in 1927. And the most often quoted words in that book come at the end of lecture two on the story, and they're on page two of the handout. Let us listen to three voices, says Forster. If you ask one type of man, what does a novel do? He will reply placidly, well, I don't know. It seems a funny sort of question to ask. A novel's a novel. Well, I don't know. I suppose it tells a story, so to speak. He's quite good-tempered and vague and probably driving a motor bus at the same time and paying no more attention to literature than it merits. Another man, whom I visualise as on a golf course, will be aggressive and brisk. He'll reply, what does a novel do? Why, tell a story, of course, and I've no use for it if it didn't. I like a story, very bad taste on my part, no doubt, but I like a story. You can take your art, you can take your literature, you can take your music, but give me a good story, and I like a story to be a story, mind, and my wife's the same. And a third man, he says in a sort of drooping, regretful voice, and I think we can assume that this drooping, regretful voice is Forster's own, yes, oh dear, yes, the novel tells a story. I respect and admire the first speaker, I detest and fear the second, and the third, as he says, is myself. Yes, oh dear, yes, the novel tells a story. That is the fundamental aspect without which it could not exist. That is the highest factor common to all novels, and I wish that it was not, so that it could be something different, melody or perception of the truth, not this low, atavistic form. Now, Forster was himself, of course, a novelist, a famous novelist, and most recently, at that time, he was the author of A Passage to India, 1924, as well as a respected critic. But the importance of Aspects of the Novel, with that disparaging attitude to storytelling that lies at the centre of it, partly comes from its institutional authority. The English faculty at Cambridge was new. It had been founded in 1919. The study of English was new. People didn't study English literature at university much before then. There were a few places that allowed it to be studied, UCL, Edinburgh, Oxford, but they tended to treat it as an ancient language in which you had to master Anglo-Saxon and Middle English, rather as you have to master Middle English, in order to see the whole lineage of things. And the texts you read would stop around 1800. Cambridge was the first place to prioritize modern texts to bring the subject up to the present day and to treat it in its own right. So Forster wasn't only delivering a point of view, he was doing so to students in a place which regarded itself as being at the cutting edge. And the people who heard his lecture and who went out in turn to be teachers and lecturers themselves promulgated these ideas of his, which had very great influence. Now, like everything he wrote, his argument is light in tone and ironic and intended to be amusing. There's none of the sort of dogmatic urgency we associate with robust modernists like Pound or with later Cambridge critics like F.R. Leavis. So perhaps we shouldn't take too seriously the precise way in which he categorizes and satirizes the answers to the questions he put. They're not bored, though you may be. They've got to go to something else. But to suggest, even if only semi-seriously, that the views of a hypothetical bus driver and the views of a businessman about fiction are not to be taken seriously, whereas the views of a novelist about what fiction should be are, is surely to discount the reader and to put on a false pedestal the literary producer, particularly when that literary producer is, for the moment, acting as a lecturer in a place of cultural power. Now, there are complicated and ultimately unanswerable questions involved in all this. Not all works of art appeal to the same people, and some works of art which are important and valuable will appeal to very few people. On the other hand, art of different kinds, of very different kinds, may be appreciated by one person, whereas the artist may feel obliged to stand up for and fight for, as well as producing, art of a particular kind. So it's very common for an artist to say, this is what art, a book should be like, my book. Anything else is rubbish. That doesn't mean that as a reader, you can't enjoy that person's work as well as something which that writer would have detested. So that the views of writers, while often very penetrating and valuable as ways into literature, have to be treated with a certain amount of caution. And an example here is the two views of Joyce and Morm in relation to style. You'll come on to Joyce next time. And here is a famous passage from Portrait of the Artist. Words, was it their colours? He, Stephen Dedalus, is on the first page of the handout, allowed them to glow and fade hue after hue. No, it was not their colours. It was the poise and balance of the period itself. Was it that, being as weak of sight as he was shy of mind, he drew less pleasure from the reflection of the sensible world through the prism of a language many-coloured and richly storied than from the contemplation of an inner world of individual emotions mirrored perfectly in a lucid, supple, periodic prose? Well, it's a long sentence and a beautiful claim for an aesthetic view of language almost removed from subject. Morm's view is very different. For long after I became a writer by profession, he says here, I spent much time on learning how to write and subjected myself to a very tiresome training in the endeavour to improve my style. But these efforts I abandoned when my plays began to be produced, and when I started to write again, it was with a different aim. I no longer sought a jewelled prose and a rich texture, on unavailing efforts to achieve which I had formerly wasted much labour. I sought, on the contrary, plainness and simplicity. Now, here we come then to that first objection that I mentioned that people raise against Morn, that his style is boring. And I want you to think about that and make your own decision about it. But I'll just make a couple of points about that. First, that Morn's plainness, his belief in short sentences and ordinary language that you don't have to have been a university student to understand, is the way writing of the next generation would go. Hemingway and Orwell are examples. So in this respect, he was ahead of his time. Secondly, the style is very accessible. It's demotic. It has all the things in favor of it that are to do with reaching to a wider rather than a smaller audience. Thirdly, he's anyway being, in my view, deceptively modest. He's capable, I think, of the most unexpected subtle touches. The moment in the pool, for example, when he talks about the frivolous elegance of the coconut trees. Or the ending of that story, when Miller and Castor drag the dead Lawson out of the water from his out of the water. He's got a rock tied to his feet. And Miller says he was set on making a good job of it as Miller wiped the water from his short-sighted eyes. Now, why is it that those words make you want to read the story again, or they make me want to read it again, as he wiped the water from his short-sighted eyes? Perhaps it's something to do with the acknowledgement of Lawson's underlying dignity and competence. He's completely screwed up his whole life. But at the end, he makes a good job of his death. And Miller acknowledges that. But there's something, too, about the short-sightedness of Miller, which is established when we first meet him, that it's almost as if there's a kind of subtext there which is to do with colonialism and the fact that that Lawson has actually made a step towards a different culture. It's worked out badly for him and for her, but he's made that attempt. Miller at the beginning said, this isn't going to work, but he's short-sighted. Maybe it's not going to work now, but in the future, perhaps it will. Perhaps there's some hint of that in Morn's story. And his anticipation of post-colonial writing is one of the things I hope you'll think about a little. Second objection, Morn's alleged misogynism. Now, to me, this criticism comes from sheer incomprehension. I think it's just wrong. It's true, of course, that Morn's work satirizes women of many kinds, but it also satirizes men of various kinds. His work is judgmental, ironic, and it exposes pretension, social conventionality, selfishness, and the cruelty that can grow out of those characteristics. Another of the things it exposes and satirizes is misogyny. That is the point, or one of the points, I think, of The Colonel's Lady. And in fact, his work is particularly alert to and sympathetic to, in my view, the new freedoms that women were claiming in his time. He was born in 1874, and if you look at the second page of the handout, I've given you some key dates in relation to the women's movement in the late 19th century and early 20th century. But the fact that 2 years before Morn was born, the National Society for Women's Suffrage was founded. Suffrage means the right to vote. That in 1882, the Married Women's Property Act for the first time recognized women as entities separate from their husbands, legal entities separate from their husbands. Until then, if you were married to somebody, you were a chattel of his, and or he took all the decisions. If you had any property, it became his. That was given up in 1882. You can go on reading down the list, and I'm not going to go through it and give you a brief history of first phase feminism. But it seems to me that, of course, Morn's fictions don't explicitly say, give votes to women, or women should be treated on equal terms with men. But these are statements that certainly represent the feeling that emerges from them if they're read rightly. More specifically and more importantly, they frequently depict women in the then world as victims of broad and deep material inequalities, and also as also, if you like, as free agents in terms of their own sexual behavior, especially in the cases of a couple of women in the novel of Human Bondage, but in the stories you've read, Miss Thompson in Rain, and Ethel in The Pool, and Eve Hamilton in The Colonel's Lady. It was an issue which always absorbed Morm. He didn't think it was at all simple. He knew that pain and suffering could come from taking your sexual behavior into your own hands. Doesn't mean you then have a great time, necessarily. But he was completely convinced that it was admirable for people to take charge of their own lives. Now, one of the dilemmas faced in Morm's work links him, to my mind, unexpectedly with T.S. Eliot in this respect. An underlying theme in Eliot's poetry are the tensions between personal reticence and sexual desire, between conventionality, conventional respectability, and something more authentic as well as more brave. It's there in early on in the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock with his anxiety, you know, and indeed there will be time to wonder, do I dare? And do I dare? Do I dare disturb the universe? Do I dare to eat a peach? J. Alfred Prufrock asks himself. And it's also there in the enigmatic outburst near the end of The Wasteland. Da, data, what have we given? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender, which an age of prudence never can retract. By this and this only have we existed. It's very, very complicated. Go back to that bit and look at it again and think about the resonance of the awful daring of surrender after the First World War. Well, how can you be brave and surrender? It's surely about giving in to a sexual impulse, a romantic impulse, which has to be a secret for whatever reason. And we know now, biographically, that Eliot was bisexual. I believe that that is, that among other things, The Wasteland is a profound examination of Eliot's consciousness and his emotional turbulence. And similarly, in Morm's work, I think that heterosexual reticence is often a code, potentially a code for, or can be read as in parallel with the idea of homosexuality. He doesn't write much about homosexuality, and for the simple reason that it was illegal. You could be sent to prison for homosexual behavior. And again, I've given you some dates on the handout, of which a key one in 1895, which was when Morm was 21, was that the imprisonment of Oscar Wilde after a series of cases, his imprisonment for homosexual acts, imprisonment to doing hard labor, which broke his health and eventually hastened his death. Morm himself was unhappily married and was gay, and he was increasingly openly and flagrantly and promiscuously gay, particularly in the south of France where he lived. But that was a very difficult situation for him in England, because he didn't somehow change into a different human being when he was in London. And it was trebly difficult because one of his elder brothers, F.H. Morm, was a High Court judge and eventually Lord Chancellor. And that was such a difficult situation that the police, the Metropolitan Police, took the Lord Chancellor aside and said, took F.H. aside and said, look, you have got to tell your brother, younger brother, Willie, that if he goes on behaving like this, we're going to have to arrest him. So that this was this pressure was there in Morm's life. And I think that the general sympathy in Morm's work for moral recklessness and the breaking of taboos and its corresponding lack of sympathy for and satire against Puritanism have that background behind them. We're left now with the objection that Morm's work is snobbish and classist. Again, I think myself that this is to mistake subject for treatment. Of course, if a writer is drawn to certain subjects we may say, well, you know, the fact that they're treating them in a different way doesn't alter the fact that they're drawn to them. The world his fiction inhabits is, and the world Morm lived in the Britain in the first half of the 20th century, was deeply snobbish and classist. And many of his characters and many of his stories reflect that. But if you take The Lion's Skin as an example, it seems to me that the point here is not to satirize the absurd guy who wants to be something he isn't and kind of carries through this con trick until he's rumbled by somebody who knows that he's not what he claims to be. But the fact that underneath this absurd and pathetic stuffiness of Forestiers is a desire not just for social position, but to be something braver and better morally than he actually is. We pick up through various hints that he actually hasn't done very much in the war, the First World War. He likes to pretend that he has, but he didn't. And there's something in him that makes him want to be brave. And in the end, he is, in a daft situation. The story is full of bathos. But he does make a sacrifice of his own life and achieves, in a paradoxical and ironic way, the standing that he previously pretended to have. Now, it is true that Morm's work sees some people as better than others, that it sees some people as more honorable, more generous, more intelligent, more talented. Or, if you like to put it negatively, it sees some people as less honorable, less generous, less intelligent, less talented than others. It assumes that there are hierarchies of other kinds, too, in the arts, and even in conversation, that some conversations are more interesting than others. But the fact that the ambassador in His Excellency is high-ranking and has good taste, don't, if you think about it, make him admirable in Ashenden's eyes. Indeed, Ashenden very shrewdly diagnoses the kind of excessive caution that makes the ambassador both achieve his position, but at the same time sort of slightly risible. He describes him as, you know, somebody on a high wire that he may fall off at any moment. And by the same token, the fact that Ethel in the pool is looked down on by people in the white community in the South Pacific doesn't mean that we look down on her. I think that the story draws out our sympathy for her and for him in a way that really ultimately earns the description tragic in terms of how their lives go. Now, when I first put Morm and Edward Thomas on the syllabus for this module, I did it because I'd come to feel that when we were talking about the experiments of the early part of the 20th century, the experiments of modernism, students didn't quite get what those experiments were, because of course some of those innovations of modernism have sort of filtered into our culture. They don't seem that daring or interesting. And also, quite often, they didn't have anything to measure these experimental texts against, anything of a more traditional and conventional kind. I thought, well, if they read some Morm, if they read some Edward Thomas, they'll know the kind of what the benchmark is against which experimentation can be judged. But the more we've talked about those writers on the syllabus, and both of them have only been, this is only the second year that they've been on, the more we've come to see that in themselves, although much more cautiously and, or not so much cautiously as subtly, if you like, they experiment with and respond to the innovations of their own time and the circumstances of their own time. So I'll be interested to know how you find Morm's stories as it were in themselves, but in relation to a period of change and experiment and of of, in some ways, revolution. Thank you very much.